Harvard Business Review had even conducted a case study of their operations. Now in their mid-30s, the pair were native New Yorkers who had known each other since working as club promoters while still in high school. Strauss, who was tall and lean with a permanent tan, and Tepperberg, who was heavy-set with a shaved head, made an odd couple, but they were nearly inseparable. After college, they began opening clubs in the Hamptons and New York. They realized clubs lived or died on who attended, and built databases of celebrities and big spenders. The pair opened Marquee in 2003, and it quickly became the hottest place in town. On a Friday or Saturday night, to secure a spot at Marquee, with its huge video screens, modern lighting, and disco ball enclosed in a spherical frame, guests had to sign contracts to order a minimum of 2 bottles of champagne or liquor, costing hundreds or even thousands of dollars each. Hollywood celebrities like Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire were regulars, and counted Tepperberg and Strauss as friends. But the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 had dented business, as Wall Street bankers shied away from dropping huge amounts in New York clubs. Lowe's advent on the scene couldn't have been better timed. Tepperberg and Strauss had seen high rollers spend thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars at a time. But Lowe was on another level. He was willing to part with millions of dollars in a night. The duo, who also owned a successful events and marketing business, made themselves available to cater to Lowe's every whim. Words of the big spending Asian also began to spread around the Hollywood types who knew Tepperberg and Strauss. It's a little discussed secret that even the biggest movie stars take payment to attend events. And Lowe began to seek out the managers of top actors, or pull on the strategic group's network of club promoters to get celebrities to his parties. The rumor that Lowe was a billionaire with unlimited funds made him an attractive person to know. Even for DiCaprio, one of the world's top-paid actors, with a sizable fortune of his own, the scope of Lowe's purported wealth was alluring. The night at the Palazzo in October 2009 was just the start of many parties the actor would enjoy with Lowe. Lowe met DiCaprio through Danny Abacasser, a club promoter for Strategic Group who was trying to carve out his own career as an actor. Top promoters like Abacasser were powerful figures in the nightlife world, bringing in big spending customers in return for a fee. While still at Wharton, Lowe had gained Abacasser's attention by laying out $3,000 in a night. Those sums had ramped up to $20,000, then $50,000. Now, Lowe thought nothing of putting down $1 million. No one had ever encountered such profligacy. The spending fed rumors among this nightclub set that Lowe was a new Asian billionaire looking to invest in Hollywood. By early November 2009, fueled by the 1MDB money, Lowe was ready to take his socializing to the next level. It was his 28th birthday, and he wanted to mark his arrival on the Hollywood scene with a splash. The festivities ran over several days, including a party at the pool area of Caesar's Palace in Vegas that featured caged tigers and lions, as well as bikini-clad models frolicking in the pool. Guests played carnival games set up at booths around the property. This was Lowe's magic, to throw the craziest party, stunning even models and actors who were used to the most sumptuous events. Some of Lowe's earliest Hollywood friends were there, including DiCaprio, the musician Usher, and Jamie Foxx, the actor and comedian. On nights when he went clubbing, Lowe acted as much as a master of ceremonies as a reveler. Often he would hold a microphone and order waiting staff to deliver Cristal champagne or Patron tequila to the whole establishment, while only sipping on a Corona himself. A poor small talker, he nonetheless developed a sense of showmanship, often shouting, "Malaysia in the house!" into his microphone. He had the Strategic Group staff draw up elaborate plans for events, including the smallest features of the decor, the flowers on display, and the alcohol behind the bar. He ensured the best-looking models were on hand to mingle with the guests. Was there a justification for all this conspicuous consumption? To Lowe, it was part of a larger design. If the parties were successful, Lowe figured, he would grow in stature, enticing more powerful figures into his world. Even an up-and-coming rap star like OT Genesis, himself not short of cash and women, was in awe after witnessing Lo one night buy multiple bottles of champagne costing $50,000 each. I'm like, what? Never, this is not for real, he said. Surrounded by women who looked like they came straight from a Victoria's Secret shoot, Genesis, who had accompanied Busta Rhymes to the party, was overwhelmed. I've never been in nothing like that. Lo was partly a calculating showman, but he struggled to be present in the moment. He was afflicted by a deep-seated compulsion that drove him to spend more, acquire more, and move incessantly. Once, he went to a mall to get juice and returned home with 8 identical pairs of black shoes. He bought Hermes Birkin bags, which start at $12,000 and go up to 6 figures for friends, friends of friends, and even people he had just met. He was the biggest spender I've ever met in my life, said one jet-setter along for the ride. You could be having lunch in a restaurant in London, and he'll say, who wants to have dinner in New York? Then he'd charter a jet, and before you know it, you're having dinner with the best wine of your life in Manhattan. Nothing was out of reach. In addition to his binge spending, people noticed another trait of Lowe's, a seemingly photographic memory. Some friends noticed he had an ability to remember very specific details of what money was moving where, down to a decimal point. He was always a bit extreme, said one person who knew him. In the autumn of 2009, the Malaysian was achieving something remarkable. In just a few short months, he had infiltrated the world's most elite circles and was becoming friends with celebrities. Some of it came down to money. He was paying for stars to attend his parties. Partly, he knew how to throw an amazing event, and with the help of Strategic Group was building a reputation as a socialite. But he was also figuring out what motivated stars like DiCaprio, and how his money could assist them to do more than just party. There was one star for whom partying and business were one and the same, a model and actor over whom he'd fantasized since his college days. It took Lo no time to befriend her. Chapter 11. Raining Cristal. Whistler, British Columbia, Canada, November 2009. Paris Hilton was getting increasingly agitated. Lo had sent a leased private jet to L.A. to whisk her to Vancouver, the nearest international airport to Whistler, the Canadian ski resort. But it had sat for 6 hours on the tarmac, while Canadian immigration decided whether to let her into the country. The holdup was due to Hilton's legal history, a DUI conviction in the United States, which had garnered worldwide press attention. Eventually, she was waved through, and Lowe's staff ferried her to the Four Seasons. It was early ski season, and Lowe was treating Hilton. Lo had contacted Hilton's manager a few months earlier and arranged for her to come along to his parties, for which she told friends that Lo paid around $100,000 per event. But there was more to Lo than simply cash, and Hilton, herself from money and with a blossoming television career, would grow close to him over the months ahead. Many people who got to know Lo described him as kind and good-hearted, and his desire to please, to ensure everyone was having a good time, compared favorably with the arrogance that often accompanies extreme wealth. Hilton brought along a friend called Joey McFarland, a native of Louisville, Kentucky, who had moved to L.A. a few years before and began helping his friends out in a business that hired stars for parties and events. Tall, with short-cropped blonde hair and an approachable, open manner that reflected his southern upbringing, McFarland got to know Hilton through the talent booking business. Only a few years earlier, he had been a small-time investor in a building in Cincinnati that housed a gyros restaurant, and his change in station made him eager to please, obsequious, even. McFarland became close to Hilton, allowing her at one point to tweet from his account that she was a celebrity princess. He would run around taking photos of her at events. She gifted McFarland a Louis Vuitton toiletries bag. At the hotel, Lo was surrounded by mainly his family and Middle Eastern friends, including Alwazan, the Kuwaiti Wharton classmate, who bragged over drinks about a recent arms deal he claimed to have done, unsettling some of Hilton's entourage. This was the first of what would become annual end-of-year ski vacations, paid for by Lowe to treat his closest friends and celebrities. Most of the group was just learning to ski. Lowe was taking snowboarding lessons, so Hilton, a practiced skier, spent most of the days on the slopes with other friends. Riza Aziz, the stepson of Prime Minister Najib, also was present. He was short, balding, and rarely said much, but his calmness was alluring to women. He was a talented tennis player and posted pictures on Facebook of himself with stars like Rafael Nadal. Relatively smart, he had entered banking after the London School of Economics and had recently quit his job in the mergers and acquisitions department of London-based HSBC. Rosma's child from an earlier marriage, Risa, was a few years older than Lowe, and even though the pair had known each other for years, their relationship was polite and formal. Since coming into Najib's orbit, Lowe was always careful to remain subservient to the Prime Minister, calling him my PM, and this extended to Rosma and her son. Now, Risa was living in Los Angeles, ready to help Lowe invest some of the money at his disposal, and that evening in Whistler led to an idea. A film buff, Joey McFarland had helped produce some low-budget movies since relocating to Los Angeles, and for months had been telling friends about his desire to start a full-fledged production company. McFarland and Risa shared an interest in cinema, and immediately hit it off on the ski trip, bonding over movies. Risa was a fan of Italian post-war neorealistic cinema, while McFarland preferred contemporary films with Hollywood A-listers like Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio. Nonetheless, a connection had been made, and over the coming weeks, Lowe, Risa, and McFarland got talking about an idea. Why not leverage Lowe's money to get into the film business? The rise of McFarland and Risa in the filmmaking world would be unexpected and meteoric. As he reinvented himself, McFarland soon would be disavowing his talent-booking past, even to those closest to him. And like others, amid the excitement of money and recognition, he would ask very few questions about the origin of Lowe's funds. On February 20th, 2010, a Saturday night, a few months after the Whistler getaway, Paris Hilton laughed while putting down bets on the baccarat table at a private room on the floor of the Palazzo in Vegas. In a matching white dress and heels, with Chanel earrings and her hair parted tightly to one side, she was celebrating her 29th birthday, carrying herself with the assurance of wealth. But even such a moneyed heritage, her family had founded the Hilton Hotel chain, had not prepared her to sit in front of $250,000 in gambling chips. Earlier in the evening, Hilton had partied at Town Nightclub in the complex, cutting a tiered birthday cake that advertised her new line and shoes. It was a typical public-private performance for the heiress, part family celebration and part promotion in front of the cameras. The after-party downstairs was more intimate, the portion that wasn't curated for the paparazzi. There, in a private gambling room, Lowe surprised her with a very generous birthday present. A Cartier watch. As if that was insufficient, he then handed her the $250,000 in gambling chips and asked her to join him at the baccarat table. Joe Lowe's party crew had begun to assemble. Apart from the celebrities, there were models. Some of these women had fallen in with the group at Las Vegas or New York clubs. Some knew the nightclub owners Tepperberg and Strauss, while others were recruited through their managers and agents. Some were only teenagers. Joey McFarland was on hand, of course, and so were Lowe's rich Middle Eastern and Asian buddies from college, like Alwasan and Seatley Lin. In Vegas, bring a jacket because it's raining crystal, ha-ha, Seat wrote on Facebook, posting a picture of himself with a Jeroboam of the champagne. As the gambling at Hilton's birthday heated up, the partygoers, Lowe's Asian clique, minor celebrities from shows like The Hills, models, and other rich kids leaned into the table. These were wealthy folk, many of whom had grown up privileged in Orange County or Santa Monica and formed the core of L.A.'s rich set. But they had never seen anyone quite like Lowe. He was putting down bigger and bigger bets, hundreds of thousands of dollars on single hands. Then, in a cascade of bad luck, taking all of 10 minutes, he lost $2 million. The stunned entourage couldn't compute the way he parted with money, seemingly without breaking a sweat. And some began to whisper about this guy, and how he acted like the cash wasn't his own. Rumors swirled. He's an arms dealer. He's connected to a foreign leader. He's some kind of overseas royalty. As the next magnum of Cristal arrived, or someone handed out thousands of dollars in chips, questions about Lowe's provenance flickered momentarily and then faded away. For all his carefree spending, Lowe knew that the money wasn't all his to fritter away. In these early stages, he began to focus on how to reward his allies. Foremost among them, Abu Dhabi executives and the family of Prime Minister Najib Razak, and start building a business that would generate profits. He needed to find a way to sustain his new life. Chapter 12. How to Spend a Billion. Los Angeles, December 2009. Lowe was looking for edge. His company, Winton, was making a $45 million all-cash bid for the L'Hermitage Hotel, a $500 a night, 117-room luxury establishment just off the Sunset Strip in Beverly Hills. But he faced a rival offer from Ian Schrager, the U.S. hotel investor, and Lowe was looking for a way to swing the deal in his favor. He turned to Mubadala, the Abu Dhabi fund. Lowe wrote the executive director of Mubadala's real estate division, asking if anyone at the fund could put in a good word for him with the seller, Tom Barrack Jr., the U.S. real estate billionaire. Khaldun al-Mubarak, the chief executive of Mubadala, promised to get Ambassador Oteiba to help. In an email to Barrack Jr., Oteiba put the official weight of Abu Dhabi behind Lowe's offer, although he did not mention the Malaysian. "I'm contacting you today to endorse this bid both as the UAE ambassador, but also as someone who understands that the full weight of a major investment entity is behind this project," he wrote. Barrack Jr. replied cordially, noting he had met Oteiba's father 30 years earlier while a young lawyer. "Mubadala and al-Mubarak are first-class investors, and we are honored at their interest," he wrote, promising to see what he could do. The bid went Lowe's way. The success of Lowe was by now important to Abu Dhabi on multiple fronts. Mubadala had recently acquired Viceroy Hotel Group, a hotel management company, and Lowe had offered to buy the L'Hermitage and then rebrand it as a Viceroy Hotel. Ambassador Oteiba had made money from his dealings with Lowe on the Iskandar land project in Malaysia, and he hoped to get in on more deals. Lowe knew the scheme would falter unless the money he'd taken was put to work, and he set out to construct a business empire. Years ago, the power of al-Mubarak at Mubadala had inspired Lowe and pushed him to create his own sovereign wealth fund. Now the Malaysian, armed with hundreds of millions of dollars, was able to do deals with Mubadala on an equal footing. Al-Mubarak did not seem to care where Lowe was getting his money. To pay for the L'Hermitage, Lowe set up a trust account at Shearman & Sterling in the name of Winton Group, and the law firm represented the company in the purchase. He then sent money into the trust from his Goodstar account, the one which had received $700 million in 1MDB cash. Lowe noted on bank documents that the money was for Stake VH. He was using his tie-up with Viceroy Hotels to give legitimacy to the huge movement of funds. He had made his first major investment, an initial step to build a reputation as a businessman. As he partied and bought assets, Lowe needed to pay back the people who had made all this possible, the family of Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. Just as he had misrepresented Prince Turki as an official Saudi envoy, Lowe was careful to keep the full scope of his actions from Najib. But in return for the long leash Najib had given him, Lowe needed to make his patron happy. From the early days of his scheme, Lowe made sure not to leave the first couple out of the profits. From the IOLTA accounts at Shearman and Sterling, he sent $3 million to Rose Trading, a Hong Kong-based jewelry trading firm that supplied Rosma. It was only the start of tens of millions of dollars of jewelry that Lowe would procure for Rosma, and soon Najib also would begin receiving spoils in the form of political funding. Beginning in 2010, Lowe also acquired multi-million dollar luxury homes in London, Los Angeles, and New York, making them available to Najib and his family. A Lowe-controlled shell firm acquired a condominium in New York's Park Laurel building, just off Central Park West, for $36 million. But it was Riza Aziz, Rosma's son, who made the 7,700-square-foot duplex with floor-to-ceiling windows his home in New York. The seller's agent was Rafael De Niro, the son of Robert De Niro, who himself would soon get to know Lowe and Prime Minister Najib Razak. The younger De Niro worked for high-end property firm Douglas Elliman Real Estate, which, like all U.S. brokers handling hundreds of millions of dollars in property transactions each year, as well as lawyers involved in real estate deals, was not required under American laws to conduct due diligence of clients' finances. In fact, De Niro didn't even need to know the ultimate buyer of a property. And Lowe purported to be representing Malaysia's prime minister or other rich buyers as he toured apartments and mansions. By 2010, faceless shell companies, many of them based offshore, accounted for more than half of the hundreds of billions of dollars in high-end U.S. property sales each year, an arrangement that was wholly legal under U.S. law. And Lowe was becoming adept at hiding his involvement. The agreement to buy the Park Laurel apartment, for instance, was signed by one Lowe-controlled firm, although it then assigned its rights to another British Virgin Islands-based shell company, which later changed its name. A Seychelles-incorporated shell company controlled by Lowe purchased a $17.5 million mansion at 912 North Hillcrest in Beverly Hills in May 2010, as a place for Riza to stay on the West Coast. Known as Pyramid House for a gold leaf-covered pyramid surrounded by a water feature in the entrance hall, the 11,573-square-foot residence had the feeling of a tropical villa, with a lap pool and semi-open rooms with sweeping views over Los Angeles. While the home underwent a major renovation, Riza often stayed in the Hermitage while in Los Angeles. Lowe, through another entity he controlled, bought an imposing red brick townhouse for £17 million in the upmarket Belgravia district of London. It was not far from Harrods, one of Rosma's favorite shops, and the Najib family would stay there on regular trips to the city. Lowe was acting as a front for the Najib clan, and eventually Riza would become the owner of all three properties, in London, Los Angeles, and New York, purchasing them from Lowe with more money stolen from 1MDB. The Malaysian was well on his way to repaying his debt to Najib for allowing him to run the fund. The Prime Minister did not pry about the origins of the money for these luxurious homes. The involvement of Lowe, who on paper was behind the purchases, allowed Najib to deny any knowledge of the fund's provenance. He was a figure who permitted the Prime Minister to keep his hands clean. Despite purchasing this string of homes, Lowe began to travel obsessively around the globe, a schedule that fit his inability to focus on the present moment. In a typical three-week period, Lowe would spend a few days in Kuala Lumpur to meet Prime Minister Najib and return home for a visit in Penang, before moving on to Singapore and Hong Kong. From there, he'd fly to Shanghai, where he had connections through his grandfather's Chinese clan, before boarding a plane to Abu Dhabi. After a quick trip to London and Paris, perhaps with an excursion to Zurich to explain a weird transfer to Swiss bankers, he'd move on to New York before finally landing in Los Angeles and making a gambling trip to Vegas. The tour finished, Lowe would fly across the Pacific to start all over again. It was a frenetic schedule that most people could not endure. Tired of leasing planes, Lowe plunked down $35 million to purchase a Bombardier Global 5000 private aircraft, drawing on the funds at Shearman and Sterling. He lived on the jet more than the many homes he was in the process of acquiring. Outfitted with a bed and mini office, complete with fax machine and Wi-Fi, he did much of his work from the Bombardier, or tapping away at all hours on his phones while in hotels and restaurants, rather than putting in regular office hours. During busy periods, Lowe worked until dawn to close a deal, but then missed meetings the next day. It was an extraordinary life, But Lowe's demure bearing gave a different impression to those people who met him only fleetingly.
"He seemed like a pretty ordinary fellow," said Joseph Kerr, the billionaire real estate investor who sold him the Bombardier.
Lowe's scheme was succeeding in fooling many in the United States. Back home, though, the stewards of 1MDB wanted to know what was going on. Chapter 13. Where's our money? Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, October 2009. On October 3rd, 2009, the atmosphere was fraught at a specially convened meeting of 1MDB's board, just as Lowe and his entourage were drawing attention to themselves in Vegas. The fund had been set up in such a hurry that it did not yet have its own permanent offices. So for this meeting, on a cloudy, humid Saturday, the board gathered at the Royal Bintang Hotel, a four-star hotel in the Mutiara Damansara neighborhood of Kuala Lumpur. Sitting around a table in the executive center, the members of the group supposed to be overseeing the operations of the fund were not happy. Most disconcerted among them was Mohamed Bakasale, a respected businessman whom Prime Minister Najib Razak had chosen as chairman of the board. Baka was the epitome of a buttoned-up chartered accountant. He had gotten his training after a degree at the London School of Economics. He dressed in dark suits, often with the same red tie, and wore wire-rimmed spectacles, his bald head framed by graying hair at the side and a neatly trimmed beard, also gray. But his appearance belied a tenacious side, and he had fought his way up the ranks to head Malaysia's largest state-owned agribusiness company. In a land of deep corruption, Baka had a reputation for doing things by the book, and in the board meeting he was furious. Why in the hell, he wanted to know, had 1MDB sent $700 million to another company and not the joint venture with PetroSaudi as the board had agreed? Sharol Halmi, the fund's chief executive, tried to reassure Baka that the money had gone to repay a loan to PetroSaudi. Sharol was a down-to-earth leader, a geek who enjoyed tech gadgets and cars and was liked by colleagues. Unlike many top executives at 1MDB, Sharol wasn't a low associate, but he quickly became addicted to the jet-setting lifestyle. There is no indication he received any payoff, but his life changed in an instant as he went from toiling on IT projects at Accenture to running a multi-billion dollar fund. Thankful for such a change of station and believing he was carrying out Najib's wishes, he hewed closely to the stories told to him by Lowe and others. In this case, that PetroSaudi was owed the money. Baka wasn't so easily duped. Why hadn't the board been informed of this debt in the first place, he demanded. There was no answer. The chairman ordered PetroSaudi to return the money, so it could be invested in the joint venture as agreed. The substantial investment of US $1 billion should have merited a more thorough thought and due diligence process, the board recorded blandly in the official minutes from the meeting. Unbeknownst to the group, the money in question was, as they spoke, being poured into nightclubs, gambling, mansions, and more. It just couldn't be returned like that. Weeks later, Baka demanded an independent audit of the oil assets that PetroSaudi was supposed to have put into the joint venture. Keen not to open a can of worms, Lowe persuaded Najib, as head of the board of advisors, to rule there would be no second valuation of the assets. Disgusted by how he had become entangled in such a mess, Baka resigned without fanfare from the board a few days later. Another director also wanted to step down, but Najib urged him to hold off for a few weeks, lest it appear the board was suffering an exodus, and he finally left in January. Lowe, who hadn't expected such a pushback, scrambled to stop further dissension. After the board had raised concerns, 1MDB's management wrote Patrick Mahoney, PetroSaudi's head of investment, to ask for more details. Mahoney must have been nervous because PetroSaudi had conducted scant business before 1MDB came along, and he emailed Lowe to ask if he should send details. "No, I wouldn't even bother sending it. Keep it simple. I want to give the board as little information as possible until PM clears the air," Lowe responded. The Prime Minister knew 1MDB was secretly fueling his political machinations, and was not as legitimate as it appeared. He was allowing an untested 28-year-old to secretly run operations, lured into the scheme by Lowe's promises the fund would enhance relationships with the Middle East and bring in investment. For years, Najib's family had used government service to line their own pockets, and Lowe's involvement in buying jewels for Rosma and properties for Riza Aziz was more of the same. For these reasons, Najib gave Lowe a wide berth and remained willfully ignorant about what the young Malaysian was up to. Even as reports about his spending in New York reached Malaysia and respected businessmen like Baca sounded the alarm. To keep the Prime Minister's trust, Lowe set about organizing another state visit to Saudi Arabia in January 2010. Ahead of the visit, he sent an email to the Obeids to stage manage the trip, asking that Saudi royals use words like personal, trust, friendship, and bond in discussions with Najib and Rosma. Saudi authorities did better than that, conferring the kingdom's top civilian award on Najib during his visit. It was the kind of honor that went a long way with the prime minister, and it showed that Lowe had deep connections. The visit handed Lowe the ammunition he needed to silence the few 1MDB board members who were continuing to complain in meetings about the missing funds. He told one member that asking too many questions about the deal with PetroSaudi, which he described as a state company, could upset bilateral relations with Saudi Arabia. "We can't insult Saudi Arabia. The PM just got a 21-gun salute on his visit," Lowe said. The board member backed off. Lowe met board members regularly for coffee and let them know he was the prime minister's representative dealing with 1MDB matters. It was vague, and Lowe's lack of official title was mysterious, but those on the board understood his power came from the top. To many, the blurry contours of his role made him seem even more powerful, and that was something he exploited. To ensure no further scrutiny of his actions, Lowe solidified his control over the board. To replace one of the vacated seats, he persuaded Najib to appoint a Malaysian Chinese from Penang, who was a business partner of his father's. Lodin Wak Kamarudin, a UMNO party loyalist who was close to Najib, became the new chairman. Lowe had seen to it that the board was now dominated by Najib loyalists. To put it another way, there was basically no independent oversight of the prime minister, Lowe and his allies in 1MDB's management. With its management hiccups cleared up, 1MDB started to look more legitimate. From its new offices on the 8th floor of Menara IMC, a gleaming skyscraper near the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, the 1MDB funds management went about building a business. Chief Executive Sharol oversaw the hiring of a group of around 10 young Malaysians with Ivy League degrees, who were enticed into the job by competitive salaries and the promise of billions of dollars in financing. The pitch was that 1MDB would be a modern kind of fund, like Mubadala in the Middle East, and would transform Malaysia by building new industries, especially green technology. An early plan was to develop a renewable energy corridor in Sarawak with investment from China and the Middle East, and the young employees set about drawing up presentations and investment plans. "We genuinely thought that helping a sovereign fund in its startup stage was a great way to make a difference for the country," said one early staff member. Working for a big sovereign wealth fund was a prestigious endeavor, but it didn't take long for disillusionment to set in among many of the new hires. The plans for the green energy business failed to gain traction, and it became clear that none of the senior management had experience running an investment fund. It was as if the bosses didn't really care about the longer-term projects, instead convening in their offices on a mezzanine floor, rarely communicating with regular employees. Everyone knew that Joe Lowe was the chief decision-maker at the fund, but he was almost never around. And for some reason, management asked staff to refer to him by a code name, UC. A joke started going around that it stood for unsavory character. Lowe's focus was on turning a profit with the money he had taken out of the fund, whether through investments in the L'Hermitage Hotel or other projects he was hoping to develop with Mubadala. This wasn't a simple bank robbery. He was wagering these businesses would take off, and the profits would easily fill the hole at 1MDB. The fund's operations proper, however, often seemed like an afterthought. At one point, Nick Faisal Arif Kamil, an associate of Lowe's who was head of investment at 1MDB, fretted in a board meeting that there was no cash flow to pay for the debt the fund had assumed. Not just the $1.4 billion in Islamic bonds, but hundreds of millions of dollars more in Malaysian bank loans. These executives started to make ridiculous suggestions. Nick Faisal even proposed that 1MDB buy a Malaysian island to turn into a vacation resort. But the idea was knocked down by the board. The fund's hallmark development, dubbed Project Wall Street, was a plan to turn Kuala Lumpur into a financial hub to rival Singapore or Hong Kong. The aim was to have Abu Dhabi's Mubadala Fund invest billions into the financial center. And 1MDB spent $2 million on a launch party in mid-2010 for the initiative. Lowe pulled strings to get the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi to attend, but when he canceled at the last minute, most of the money for the party was lost, and the financial center plan made little progress. Kuala Lumpur's stock market and banking sector just weren't important outside the country, and potential investors were hard to find. Still, Lowe persuaded Najib to grant the fund parcels of vacant city center land at bargain basement prices for the project. Amid the wasted spending and the lack of focus, many of the Ivy League recruits quit after less than a year. More worryingly to many, it became clear the fund's main reason to exist was as a pot of political money to boost Najib's popularity. Even without steady cash flow from operations, 1MDB was starting to channel money as corporate social responsibility to help encourage voters to support UMNO, the ruling party. We even joked that many of the projects we were assessing were pretend projects to give the company a legitimate front, the 1MDB employee said. On March 1, 2010, the new board of loyalists met at 1MDB's new offices to discuss how the fund could help Najib's premiership. Even though it still had no viable businesses, Chief Executive Sharol explained to the board how a new charity arm of 1MDB was planning to pour money into the Malaysian region of Sarawak to coincide with an upcoming visit by Najib. The jungle-covered state, though remote and relatively unpopulated, was crucial to the UMNO party's grip on national power. Loden, Najib's friend and chairman of the board, responded that getting the support of the natives, by which he meant Sarawak's tribal peoples, some of whom still lived in longhouses in the jungle, was crucial. The board agreed without debate to provide more than $500,000 for school scholarships and housing for the poor, which Najib could promote when he visited. The Prime Minister's office staff was tasked with coming up with projects like funding schools in important voting districts, and 1MDB would provide the finances. If we thought it could help the incumbent government pull in some votes, we could propose that, said Oi Soon, Najib's political secretary at the time. From the start, Najib was obsessed with popularity. Like any old-school Malaysian politician, he saw money, not ideas, as the only way to achieve popularity with voters, and he squeezed 1MDB for funds. A few months after the 1MDB board meeting, Najib told voters ahead of an upcoming local election in Sarawak that he would arrange federal funding for local projects only if the ruling party candidate won. "You help me, I help you," a sweating Najib promised in a stump speech ahead of the voting. It was a picture of the rot in Malaysian politics. Chapter 14. Roll the Presses. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, December 2009. Some among Malaysia's elite, hearing whispers about Mohamed Bakasale's resignation, guessed something was not right at 1MDB. Yet the fund's problems remained unknown to the general public, in part because Najib's government controlled the mainstream media. But there was one media tycoon the prime minister could not order around so easily. Tong Kui Ong, owner of The Edge, an English-language weekly business newspaper. The mass-market papers, mostly pro-government, were in Malay or Chinese. The Edge catered to the country's business elite. For years, Tong had been the rebel of Malaysia's business community. The 50-year-old, with tufts of black hair on either side of his head and a bald skull, preferred open-neck shirts to suits. He once told his wife he had a premonition he would die before 50, and he needed to live fast before then. He could be bad-tempered with people he considered dim-witted, but he was equally charming, his face often breaking out into an impish smile. It was a combination that riled up the entitled ruling party elites in Kuala Lumpur. When Tong heard the rumors about 1MDB, the newspaper man decided The Edge needed to investigate. In Malaysia, most major papers were subservient to the government. The ruling UMNO party directly owned some of the largest circulation papers, whose editors slavishly put out puff pieces on politicians and policies. Newspapers had to renew their publishing licenses every year. Given the government's control, even editors at independent newspapers often self-censored. The arrival of The Edge, in the mid-1990s, shook up the industry. Unlike other papers, The Edge did not shy away from writing about corruption scandals, which Tong viewed as harmful to Malaysia's economic prospects. He had built his own fortune and was beholden to no one, and that made him a threat. The sixth of nine children of a Chinese-Malaysian car mechanic, Tong had grown up in the 1960s and 1970s in the gritty Malaysian port town of Klang, not far from Kuala Lumpur. His family scraped together enough to send him to university in Canada, where he eventually earned a master's degree in finance and taught himself computer science. Returning to Malaysia in the 1980s, Tong became a securities analyst at a Malaysian firm before moving to British bank Morgan Grenfell, helping to value companies. But he was ambitious and restless, and by the 1990s he bought his own securities company and soon after acquired a full banking license. In the clubby world of Malaysian business, Tong was considered a maverick, and he quickly made enemies. By bringing online trading to Malaysia, he undercut other brokers, who came to view him as a dangerous upstart. Foreign fund managers liked Tong, however, and he quickly won a large share of their business in Malaysia. His cocksure manner, obvious intelligence, and contempt for mediocrity irritated financiers who owed their success to years of ties with the establishment. He also was political, but bet on the wrong horse. Tong befriended Anwar Ibrahim, a charismatic deputy prime minister, sensing he would soon become the nation's top leader. But in the late 1990s, Anwar fell out with Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, who had ruled Malaysia since 1981. When Anwar fell, jailed on trumped-up charges of sodomizing a male aide, homosexuality is illegal in Malaysia, Tong was cast out into the wilderness. Amid rumors that Mahathir would seize his assets, the businessman returned to Canada, transforming himself into a successful property developer in Vancouver. But he could never remain in one place for long, and after Mahathir stepped down in 2003, Tong came back to Malaysia. Mahathir had forced Tong to sell his bank, but Tong still controlled The Edge. The newspaper had built a loyal following. If the press wasn't exactly independent, at least Malaysia wasn't a dictatorship, and The Edge's editors had learned to push the limits of free expression, writing stories on corruption while maintaining their license. Some topics were off-limits, say corruption stories about a prime minister. By focusing more on business than politics, its editors had stayed on the right side of the government. In late 2009, Tong began to hear rumors about 1MDB. From the start, elite Malaysians gossiped about Najib's administration. Malaysian diplomats complained about having to organize Rosma's shopping trips when she was abroad. More recently, Tong had started to hear more alarming complaints. Bankers told him the Terengganu Fund, the predecessor of 1MDB, had sold its Islamic bonds too cheaply. That meant whoever bought the bonds could resell them in the market for a handsome profit. Rumor had it that companies connected to Lowe had benefited. This kind of trick was common in Asia's capital markets. Now, at cocktail parties in Kuala Lumpur, the talk was of Baca's abrupt resignation from the fund's board. Tong was a visionary, not a details man. He could be disorganized, his offices a mess of papers and odd objects, including, for a time, a little-used treadmill. To implement the coverage of 1MDB, he leaned on Ho Ke Tat, a veteran journalist who was publisher of The Edge. Ho's mane of gray hair, glasses, and eagerness to please in conversation made him seem grandfatherly, even though he was only in his 50s. But his avuncular appearance belied a tenacity to dig for the truth. Ho had built his career as a well-paid senior editor at The Star, a government-aligned newspaper based in Lo's home state of Penang. But he had been unable to deal with the constant requests to kill negative stories about UMNO-linked companies, and he had jumped at the chance in the 1990s to join The Edge. While government mouthpieces like The Star and The New Straits Times pushed out softball pieces on Najib's administration, The Edge under Ho took a critical stance. Backed by Tong, Ho tagged a small team of reporters to start digging. In December 2009, The Edge published a story raising questions about 1MDB. Why had Baca resigned from the board so soon after the fund's inception? Why had the Terengganu Investment Authority sold its bonds so cheaply, despite being a risk-free, state-owned entity? What exactly was the purpose of 1MDB, and what was it doing with the money? One name that appeared nowhere in the piece, Joe Low. He was nonetheless disturbed by it, and began talking off the record to journalists at The Edge, trying to persuade them that 1MDB was a genuine investment vehicle. It would be 3 years more before The Edge began to uncover the truth. For now, Lowe's secret was safe. In fact, his star was on the rise. Chapter 15. Welcome to New York. New York, April 2010. The guests, wearing tuxedos and ball gowns, made their way up to the ballroom of the St. Regis Hotel, just off Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. It was April 16th, 2010, a rainy and windswept evening. But the mood was ebullient at one of the city's most stylish hotels. Najib and his wife Rosma were in especially good spirits. A few days earlier, President Barack Obama had granted Najib a bilateral meeting on the sidelines of a nuclear security summit in Washington. Obama, the first black American elected to the U.S. presidency, was a global icon, and Najib sensed an opportunity for a new dawn in relations between the countries. After the Obama meeting, Low was pulling on his connections to ensure the Malaysian first couple made a splash during their trip. And the night at the St. Regis was the centerpiece of that effort. The event was hosted by the Business Council for International Understanding, a little-known organization set up under President Dwight Eisenhower to foster ties between world business and political leaders. The night at the St. Regis was to honor Rosma, on whom the council had decided to bestow its International Peace and Harmony Award. The award, the council said, was in recognition for work Rosma had done with children's charities back in Malaysia. She had set up a children's education organization, but it was financed by public money, and critics at home wondered why the education ministry didn't just distribute the cash. If the council clearly hadn't done its homework, that was fine with Najib and Rosma. Awards like this, while essentially meaningless tokens, were crucial to the likes of Rosma, who detested the whispers about the origins of her money. To trumpet the award, the Malaysian government spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a double-page advertisement in the New York Times to coincide with her visit, congratulating the First Lady with a full-page photo of Rosma and the words, "Welcome to New York." To ensure the St. Regis party's success, Low contacted Saleh Gebreyesus, the Eritrean-American contact who had arranged the details of Prince Turki's meeting with Najib aboard the Alfa Nero. He invited a bevy of Hollywood stars, many of whom would seem unlikely attendees at an award dinner for an Asian politician's wife. The event started at 6:30 p.m. with cocktails and an Islamic fashion show before dinner. Jamie Foxx, the actor and comedian, emceed the proceedings. A number of stars, including Robert De Niro and Charlize Theron, were in attendance, giving the event a buzz. Wearing a traditional Malay sarong and loose-fitting embroidered top, both in a deep yellow color, with a diamond-encrusted bangle around her wrist and sparkling earrings, Rosma was ecstatic at the attention. When dinner concluded around 10 p.m., the party really got going. Pop star Leona Lewis sang. Foxx dragged Rosma up on stage for a flirty rendition of You've Got a Friend, and he danced with Najib. Later, De Niro, Theron, and others joined Foxx on stage to sing We Are the World, one of Lo's favorites. It was like a wedding, bar slash bat mitzvah, sweet 16, quinceañera, all rolled up into one, wrote Wendy Brandis, a jewelry designer who was present. I was awestruck. A few months later, De Niro, taking up an invite from Rosma, traveled to Malaysia on a vacation. Rosma told local media that she wanted him to see the country for himself, rather than believe any negative stories he had heard. Through Joe Lo's extravagant spending, and the expectation, perhaps, of a new source of film financing, Hollywood stars were taking notice of Malaysia. Yet again, Lo had made himself indispensable. Najib and Rosma felt like Lo could work magic, organizing state visits to the Middle East and, now, attracting the glamour of Hollywood. Lo, however, had an even bigger target, confiding in Ambassador Oteiba that he hoped to deepen Najib's relationship with President Obama. For years, ties between Malaysia and the United States had been lukewarm at best. Former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad was confrontational toward the United States, bashing Western imperialism and blaming Jewish financiers for the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. Western governments decried the jailing of Anwar Ibrahim for sodomy as a political vendetta. On an official visit to Kuala Lumpur, Vice President Al Gore urged the brave people of Malaysia to push for democracy, infuriating Mahathir. By the time Najib came to power, no sitting U.S. president had visited Malaysia since Lyndon B. Johnson in the 1960s, when the United States was entrenched in the Vietnam War. At their April 2010 meeting, Najib presented himself to Obama as a different political animal. The prime minister was a self-professed Anglophile and talked about deepening democratic reforms. On the face of it, he seemed to be a leader the United States could rely on in the region. He appeared urbane, spoke good English, and made the right noises about Islam, having recently launched a global movement of moderates, an effort to get Islamic countries around the world to condemn Islamist violence. President Obama was keen to extricate the United States from costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and wanted to shift focus to East Asia, where he was seeking to counterbalance China's influence on the fast-growing economic zone. In a speech in Australia the following year, Obama would underline this pivot to Asia, and Najib, along with the leaders of Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, and Australia, was viewed by the president and his White House advisors as key to the effort. It was a good start, and Lo would do all he could in the years ahead to ensure Najib and the American president got even closer. Chapter 16. Shitty Junk Products. Washington, D.C., April 2010. As Najib visited New York, the United States was engulfed in political upheaval. The financial crisis, originating in America, had spread to Europe, throwing millions out of work and their homes, causing a deep recession and inspiring the Occupy Wall Street protests. The anger at Wall Street banks, many of which had prospered during the crisis, was palpable. In late April, Goldman's chief executive, Lloyd Blankfein, tried to stay calm as he answered angry questions from U.S. senators about the Wall Street Bank's role in the financial meltdown. Senator Carl Levin, a Democrat from Michigan who headed a Senate subcommittee that had spent 18 months looking into Goldman's actions, wanted to know why the bank had sold securities backed by toxic subprime mortgages to clients, while at the same time betting against them. Levin gave example after example of deals that Goldman sold to clients that its bankers described privately in emails as shitty and junk. "It raises a real ethical issue," Levin said, his demeanor hostile, as he sat opposite Blankfein. In the public gallery, protesters dressed in fake prison jumpsuits held up pink signs with the word shame, and photos of Blankfein's head mounted on sticks. In the mid-2000s, Wall Street's profits soared due to a boom in the U.S. housing market. As Americans signed up for loans to buy homes with little or even no money down, banks took these poor quality mortgages, known as subprime loans, and packaged them into securities, which they sold to big investment funds. At Goldman, both Blankfein and Gary Cohn, the bank's president, who would go on to serve as President Donald Trump's chief economic advisor, pushed subprime debt products, which the bank continued to market in the run-up to the crisis. But fearing a crash in home prices, with many Americans unable to keep up on their mortgage payments, Goldman itself had bet against the market, a trading strategy that later came to be known as the big short. When the U.S. housing bubble burst in 2007, these subprime securities blew up. Within a year, losses related to toxic subprime loans toppled Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, sparking a full-blown financial crisis. The U.S. government had to step in with a $700 billion bailout for the banks. The Goldman chief executive, dressed in a gray suit with a maroon tie, tried to parry the angry questions from Senator Levin, arguing that some clients, big banks and institutional funds, still believed the U.S. housing market was robust in 2007. It was no fault of Goldman's, he said, if those clients desired to acquire securities linked to subprime home loans. "They wanted to have a security that gave them exposure to the housing market," Blankfein said. The unfortunate thing is the housing market went south. Goldman did not operate retail bank branches, and few Americans knew much about investment banks, whose clients are largely companies, governments, pension funds, high net worth individuals, and other banks. But Blankfein was becoming the poster boy for financial sector greed. The collapse of the housing market had left many Americans destitute. Goldman's profit, by contrast, soared to a record $13.4 billion in 2009. Senator John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, asked Blankfein to tell the room his bonus for the year. Visibly ill at ease, the chief executive stuttered before responding, "It was $9 million. The 140-year-old bank was on the defensive. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, which enforces securities laws and regulates the industry, was suing Goldman for withholding information from a German bank to which it sold a subprime mortgage product. A young French trader at Goldman named Fabrice Touré, who referred to himself in emails as Fabulous Fab, had talked about selling the product, known as Abacus, to widows and orphans. 3 months after Blankfein's appearance in Congress, Goldman settled with the SEC for $550 million, the largest ever penalty paid in a civil case by a Wall Street firm. It apologized for giving incomplete information to its client, but did not admit wrongdoing. Senator Levin later asked for a criminal investigation of Goldman, but the U.S. Justice Department decided not to pursue charges, adding to a sense that Wall Street bankers walked away scot-free from the crisis they created. Even though no senior Goldman executives were sanctioned, however, banks were under scrutiny like never before. In 2010, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act, a sweeping series of laws brought in as a response to the financial crisis. The Volcker Rule, proposed by former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, restricted banks from speculative trading that did not benefit their customers. The idea was this kind of activity, say, betting on risky subprime securities, destabilized the financial system and hurt ordinary savers and homeowners. Banks would fight a rearguard action in Congress. The rule was watered down, permitting certain investments, and took years to come into effect. But Wall Street banks had to stop acting like hedge funds.